From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Brian Eno on bringing avant-garde thinking and electronic sound manipulation into rock music. Also today, we meet singer and guitarist Robert Cray. He was influenced by bluesmen like Howlin' Wolf, as well as the rock and soul of the 60s. Today, he's bringing blues and soul into the 90s. World music critic Milo Miles introduces us to the Royal Macadamians, and Mark Halliday reads a poem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A high Iraqi official told reporters in Jordan today that his country prefers war to surrender in the Persian Gulf crisis. Taha Yassin Ramadan is Iraq's deputy prime minister. He ruled out an Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait, saying Iraq cannot withdraw from its own country. Ramadan called instead for an unconditional settlement that would also deal with the Palestinian question in Lebanon. The deputy prime minister re-emphasized Iraq's positive attitude to recent French proposals that other Middle Eastern problems be discussed as part of a peaceful settlement. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev said today he doesn't think the crisis in the Persian Gulf will lead to war. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Gorbachev was meeting at the Kremlin with a senior official from Oman to discuss improving relations between Moscow and the Persian Gulf state. Reporters took the opportunity to ask Gorbachev whether he believes the Gulf crisis will result in war. "I don't think so," Gorbachev answered. Reporters then followed up by asking Gorbachev whether the Soviet Union will take part if there is a war. Gorbachev's answer, "I think there are more than enough troops there." The Soviet Union is in the midst of a diplomatic effort of its own in the Middle East. On Tuesday, the Soviet president sent a high-level envoy to Jordan and Iraq. He is said to be seeking a diplomatic solution to the crisis and exit permits for thousands of Soviet citizens trapped in Iraq. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
A reunited German government is discovering an economic disaster in what was communist East Germany. The BBC's Diana Goodman reports from Berlin.
The West Germans admit they underestimated the size of the economic disaster in the East because of the false statistics issued by the old communist regime. At one time, East Germany was thought to have a strong industrial base and a well-trained workforce. But the truth is that many factories are so antiquated they're not worth saving, and they're staffed by workers whom the West Germans judge to be lazy and lacking any sort of drive. The latest estimate is that half of the East German workforce could be claiming unemployment benefits by the end of the year. The government will also have to spend millions of dollars on updating East Germany's hopeless telephone network, and the roads will have to be brought up to West German standards, along with the crumbling housing stock.
The BBC's Diana Goodman. The dollar fell sharply today in relation to foreign currencies, a sign that traders are taking seriously the promise of lower U.S. interest rates. The dollar hit an all-time low today against the German mark. Currency traders started selling dollars after Federal Reserve Chief Alan Greenspan told Congress that passage of the deficit reduction agreement would lower interest rates. Prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 28 points to close at 2,516.83. Volume on the New York Exchange was 145 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Brian Eno is well known in the worlds of rock and experimental music. He brought the conceptualism of the classical avant-garde into the world of rock. In 1971, he co-founded the British band Roxy Music with Brian Ferry. Eno played synthesizer and electronically manipulated the sounds of the other musicians in the group. Eno left Roxy Music, made albums on his own, and started his own label that recorded albums of atmospheric electronic music. He became an important figure in the new wave scene of the 70s, producing records by Talking Heads and Devo. Eno has also produced records by David Bowie, Robert Fripp, and U2. Now, for the first time in 13 years, he sings on a record of songs. The album Wrong Way Up is a collaboration with John Cale. Eno sings on this song, Lay My Love, which was co-written by Eno and Cale. record is really a return to song for you. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to go back to songs?
The question I hate answering.
Because it's too hard or because you don't want to admit it?
No. I guess it's the main reason I didn't do a song record for so long, because they're always seen as so separate in everyone's mind that it's either songs or not songs. I suppose it's easier to tell you why I didn't do song records for a long time.
Okay.
And the main reason for that was because I was trying to make a kind of music that wasn't so personality-based and that wasn't really based on the idea of a musical performance, of a performance having happened somewhere, of which this was a record, you understand. I wanted to do something that was music as if it, or sound that had been recorded somehow without the intervention of human beings, in particular me. So I left the voice out of things for quite a long time. But I never stopped singing. I've always been a singer, I guess.
Now, you're still working on your ambient music also, right? Your electronic mm-hmm. music. Would you describe what the ambient music is?
It started out as really a response. I mean, like all my music starts, I guess, as me thinking, I wish some music like this existed. I imagine a kind of music that I would like to hear. It doesn't exist, so I start to make it. Or I hear something, on the other hand, and I think, God, if only they'd done it this way, it could have been so much better. So I sometimes start by remaking other things that I hear in what I consider to be an incomplete form. Well, the whole ambient thing really arose from watching the way that people were listening to music as opposed to the way that composers were making music. There seemed to me that there had developed a big lag in between those two operations. Composers were still making records as though people ran back home with the disc or the CD and sat down in front of their speakers with their attention riveted and listened to every detail and nuance of the recording. Well, of course, that used to happen, but and it still does. It's rather the classical music model of listening. What more typically happened is that people would buy the record, take it home, put it on, get on the phone, do the washing up, vacuum clean, do all the sorts of things that one does, write a letter, read a book, and have the music on at the same time. So I thought it was quite clear to me that people were using music much more as a form of landscape, really.
Mm-hmm.
They were creating an atmosphere for themselves by means of music. And I thought also that most music was not designed with that idea in mind, and in a certain sense it didn't work very well for that job. So I wanted to make a music that could allow you to do that, that could occupy different attention spaces in your life so that you could stop and listen to it and give it that kind of old-fashioned attention, or you could just have it playing and get on with something else. It didn't demand particular levels of attention. It offered the option of lots of different ones.
You have a record that is still a work in progress now. You're still working on it, but we have mm-hmm. a couple of tracks from this forthcoming album. And mm-hmm. I want to play something that you've called Ripples in Time. Mm-hmm. Would you put this in the category of the ambient music?
Yes, I would. That piece isn't quite finished yet, but I'm hoping... In fact, I'm trying, I haven't succeeded yet, to add a 16-piece string orchestra to this piece. And we've done a little work on that, but it hasn't quite worked out yet. So this could become rather a different piece from what it sounds like at the moment. But it certainly fits in that same category, I think. Ambient also is rather a good alibi for slipping what can be quite abstract pieces of music to people in a way that doesn't intimidate them. You know, if you say, hey, you know, this is nothing in particular, just you can treat it as background music if you like, it gives you a certain freedom to operate outside of any of the known sets of expectations about what music should be. So I'm kind of interested in using that category as a way of generating a kind of post-classical contemporary music. And I hope that pieces like this will be the beginning of that.
Well, let's listen to Ripples in Time, and this is A Work in Progress by Brian Eno. Composer, musician, producer, and synthesizer player Brian Eno is my guest. Now, you came to music from art school when you were still a student. You were in art school. You didn't play an instrument. You didn't read music, but you had a synthesizer, which of course is an instrument, and you were using a tape mm-hmm. recorder, I think, in very musical ways, manipulating it. Mm-hmm. How has that continued to shape your sense of who you are as a musician? Do you still think of yourself as a non-musician, even though you've been playing music for so many years?
I do, I suppose. Yes, I think that the tape recorder was certainly the most important thing for me, because the tape recorder, as far as I was concerned, turned music into a plastic art. It meant that it was possible to do all sorts of operations to sound that didn't actually require traditional musical talents. So I started out working in music with quite a different idea about what music could be, and that idea hasn't really changed. It's just been enlarged, but at the basis I still have this feeling that music is now a new art since the tape recorder.
Well, it's interesting to me that you have this, pretty avant-garde sense of what music is or can be. And you've chosen to take that concept to pop music as opposed to, say, the classical avant-garde. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of your ideas initially would have been much more at home in the classical avant-garde, because there were other composers there thinking along similar lines, where it was very unusual to find someone with ideas like that in pop music.
Yes. I had quite a strong connection with the classical avant-garde at first. That was really my first musical connection. When I was at art college, I was in contact with people like Christian Wolff and Cornelius Cardew. And, of course, I knew what Cage was writing about and so on. So that was sort of the license which allowed me to think that I might be able to do something in music, because a lot of things they were talking about were for non-musicians or for unskilled players, that kind of thing. There was suddenly an idea in the mid-60s that you didn't really have to have gone through the whole academy in order to be able to play music. It was not quite so mysterious. And then at the end of the 60s, a pop group appeared that had a very big influence on me, which was the Velvet Underground, of course, the band that John was in. And one of the things they kind of traded on was a mixture of talent from Maureen Tucker, the drummer, who was really a non-musician. She normally played one drum, to Sterling Morrison and John, who were both very good musicians, and Lou Reed, who was maybe somewhere in between. And this, they made quite a point of the fact that this was permissible and in fact could lead to exciting results. Now, I was temperamentally always attracted to popular music. It was what I liked and what I listened to. And I liked the ideas of classical avant-garde music. But I must say, I discovered that that was not what I was listening to for sound. For sound, it was pop music where it was happening for me.
My guest is Brian Eno. He's a composer, musician, singer, record producer, and he's really one of the most important people in bringing electronics and avant-garde thinking into pop and the new wave. He has a forthcoming album. It's just about to come out. It's called Wrong Way Up, and it's a collaboration between Brian Eno and John Cale. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Brian Eno is my guest. In the 1970s, you became a very important producer of new wave bands like Talking Heads. I think some of the new wave bands were into what you were talking about before, approaching music from a non-musician's perspective, or at least from a musician's perspective where technique wasn't the primary way of measuring whether the music was good or not. It was more about feeling and sound and rhythm. What did you want to put into that music? How would you describe the vision that you were bringing to the new wave bands in the late 70s?
Well, you're quite right that I felt that identity with it. I thought that this was a whole movement that shared a philosophical position with the one I'd been working around. I suppose what I felt was that there was something else that could happen as well. It didn't just have to be walk in and bash the instruments hard and walk out again. That there were certain kinds of delicacy that were allowable and actually very fruitful. And my progress through the 70s, if I can call it progress, was towards putting more and more emphasis as a composer on the landscape that I was creating, the musical context within which the song existed, and quite often leaving out the song entirely in the end. So I was really working with texture, and I thought that this was something that I knew about as a result of having by then spent a fair amount of time in studios and worked with electronics and synthesizers and so on. And that was really what I was interested in bringing to those collaborations.
Mm-hmm. Let me get to another aspect of non-musicianship. You produced the Portsmouth Sinfonia records, and this was an orchestra of musicians who really couldn't play and who would play classical war horses like the William Tell Overture or Thus Spake Zarathustra. And it was, you know, like the most ragged assemblage you'd ever hear. Did you organize the band?
No, that was the brainchild of Gavin Bryars, an English composer. And it was called the Portsmouth Sinfonia because he was teaching at Portsmouth College of Art, and that grew out of that place, but then it attracted a much wider membership. At our peak, we had, I think, 80 members in the orchestra, and our biggest ever concert, we had an 80-piece orchestra and a 320-piece choir. We did Handel's Hallelujah Chorus at the Royal Albert Hall. But I just must correct something, actually. Funnily enough, it wasn't entirely non-musicians. The rule with that orchestra was that anybody could join. Now, they could also be musicians. They didn't have to be non-musicians, but anybody could join. But the rule was that if they joined, they had to turn up at the rehearsals, and they had to try their hardest to play it right.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the players had no musical background. This was guaranteed to fail in an interesting way. But some of the players were actually very skilled, and this was what made it musically interesting, I think, because occasionally you'd hear a thread of very nimble playing amidst this near chaos that was going on most of the time.
Is that what made the project interesting to you?
Yeah, I liked, I loved that. I learnt a lot about music playing in the Portsmouth Sinfonia, more than probably any other experience I've had. Because if you get people who can't play instruments very well trying to play melodies that they know, everyone knew the tunes, you know, they were always Beethoven's Fifth and, as you say, the war horses of classical music. Probably the only thing they'll manage to do is to follow the rough shape of the melody. They'll go up when it goes up, and they'll go down when it goes down, but not by the right amount more often than not. So what you got was classical music reduced to its to a sort of statistical averages, where you know, where the sum total was kind of roughly recognizable. It was very exciting orchestra to be in. We fired a couple of people because they played around. The one thing that wasn't tolerated was people deliberately making jokes or trying to make it sound funny. It sounded funniest when everyone was trying hard to get it right, and it didn't sound funny when people larked around and made silly noises, you know. So we really did rehearse, and we realized that the quality of the failure depended on how hard we tried to succeed. And we tried very hard.
Brian Eno is my guest. Have you ever gone through a crisis of becoming too proficient at either composing or at using the electronics that you use, or tape manipulation? You know, coming from this non-musician background and being informed by the Portsmouth Sinfonia stuff about how something sounds when you're really trying hard to do it right and mm-hmm. you can't. Mm-hmm. People like you get really good, you know?
Well, it's a good question, because I think what happens, it's not so much the over-proficiency that's a problem. It's the lack of alertness that goes with knowing how to do something well. Once you know how to do something quite well, or you're familiar with doing it a lot of times, you automatically are falling into routines. You know exactly how that works. You switch it on, you do this, you do that, you do that. And all of that is sort of done on automatic. And While you're on automatic, you're not listening any longer. One of the reasons that people who don't play instruments well are sometimes able to do surprising things with them is that they're listening at a much more basic level than skilled performers are. They start asking questions like, hey, does this sound interesting? Yeah, it does. at quite a different point from where the professional performer would. He's already been through that. He's already working at a level where he considers all those questions have been answered long ago. They're not interesting to him anymore. So I think this is the problem. It's not proficiency. It's the switching off of your alertness that goes with thinking you are proficient on something. So the trick is to think of ways of surprising yourself back into hearing freshly again. And that's something that really requires thinking and techniques of thinking. It's something you can do quite consciously. You can set yourself exercises that trick you into hearing something differently.
If I could just bring this around to what we were talking about at the beginning, which is your first album of songs in a long time, and I know you were finding it hard to talk about songs or why you were writing them, but I wonder if this connects at all, that since you hadn't been doing albums of songs for a while, maybe there was a freshness in it? In returning?
You know, when you're working on something and you're carrying out a course of work and people react to it, you sort of lose your innocence about it in a way. There are all sorts of expectations, like you're suddenly very important, or you're the villain of the piece, or whatever you are. You're being cast in... You cast a big shadow, you know, much bigger than you probably intended. And there's a momentum to that kind of... public acclaim, actually, public and critical acclaim and condemnation, that tends to harden positions too much. You have to defend a position, or you have to condemn a position. There's a momentum to repeat successes, to brake modes, all the various different things, you're not operating in quite the same mental context as I was when I first started making records, where I just thought, this sounds good, I'll release it. with very little thought of what anyone expected of me or what the rest of the world would think about it, or whether the rest of the world would even care about it. Well, this kind of gets a pressure after a while, and it distorts your judgments. And it's sort of an act of courage to ignore that, or to at least work out what one's relationship is to it. About 2 years ago, my father died, and earlier this year, my wife gave birth to a daughter. Now, those two events seem to me so much more important in so many ways than anything else, that it suddenly made all these distinctions between this type of music as opposed to that, this idea as opposed to that, it made them seem rather trivial. Instead of being hundreds of miles apart from one another, in relation to these other things, they seemed rather close together, and it seemed to me that I had a lot of freedom suddenly to move between them. I didn't any longer feel that to do one thing was the dereliction of a position or was a condemnation of something else. So this year I felt very happy, because I think that I've sort of opened up the dynamic of my work, and I can really work anywhere along the spectrum of things that I can do, and not feel that I don't feel ideological about it anymore. I think that's the thing. I feel that it all probably fits together in the end, but I don't care if it doesn't.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot.
Brian Eno's new album is a collaboration with John Cale called Wrong Way Up. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's one of Brian Eno's songs from the new album.
So deep in the water, sleep dark as the night. Somehow it seems it was all.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. World music critic Milo Miles has a change of pace from all those over-earnest albums featuring American and British musicians trying to incorporate world rhythms. He reviews an album by the band The Royal Macadamians. Robert Cray has become very popular for his records of contemporary blues and soul music. Coming up, Cray tells us what he doesn't relate to about the blues. And we have a poem by Mark Halliday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the House is expected to vote later on this evening on the agreement to cut $500 billion from the federal deficit. House Speaker Tom Foley met with President Bush over lunch today to talk about strategy for the vote. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Faced with continuing opposition to the cuts in Medicare and increases in taxes on gasoline, cigarettes, and alcohol, the backers of the budget agreement, the president and congressional leaders, have begun to change their marketing plan. House Speaker Foley told reporters after his lunch with Mr. Bush that the agreement will not be renegotiated, but the package is really just a model.
Many of the policies outlined in the budget summit were for illustrative purposes, and there would be the possibility of looking at alternative policies in order to achieve the same savings.
What Foley is saying is that it's up to the congressional committees to work out the details of the plan, and that by voting for the budget package today or tomorrow, lawmakers won't be voting for every detail outlined in the plan. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
And the U.S. aircraft carrier Independence has left the Persian Gulf after a four-day stay to show military support for Gulf states against Iraq. According to the Pentagon, there are now more than 170,000 U.S. military personnel in the area. A top Iraqi official says that his country will go to war rather than surrender Kuwait. At a news conference in Jordan, Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Ramadan threatened reporters with amputation if they tried to enter the occupied country illegally to verify reports of human rights abuses. NPR's Alan Tomlinson reports from Jordan.
Ramadan flew here for talks with King Hussein and the visiting Japanese Prime Minister Toshiki Kaifu. Afterwards, he told reporters that Iraq now regards Kuwait as an inseparable part of its territory and would rather go to war than surrender it. Ramadan, the number three in the Iraqi leadership, was challenged by reporters to let them into Kuwait to verify allegations by Amnesty International of tortures and executioners by Iraqi troops. Ramadan denied the allegations, then warned reporters,
"We'll cut off the leg of any person who will enter Kuwait illegally, or we do not wish him to enter Kuwait."
Ramadan went on to say that Iraq was willing to enter dialogue to solve the crisis, but not if its only aim was an Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait. In Jordan, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
In Washington, the State Department says another group of Americans will be flown out of Iraq and Kuwait next week on a U.S. government chartered flight. The exact number was not announced, but a Boeing 747 has been chartered. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 27 points to close at 2,516.83 on volume of 145 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. We'll talk about the blues with musician Robert Cray later on the show. First, an offbeat album by an L.A. band called the Royal Macadamians. World music critic Milo Miles says they found a casually apt way to integrate rock and roll and international sounds. You can get a sense of their irony from this song, Relax in Lebanon.
Languid afternoons on the exclusive private beaches. Cool evenings, cruising the Corniche in an open car. Fine wines, fine meats. The most beautiful women and boys of five continents converge in Western Asia's premier Playboy playground.
Just how should a rock and roll band go about assimilating world music? It's a burning question in pop. Well, it is for me, at least. Considering how hit and miss the mergers of even reggae and rock have been, there's cause to wonder if non-English pop will ever fit in with American bands. To my taste, international pop fusion hasn't been done right yet, though Peter Gabriel and a few others have come close. A persistent problem is that so much of the material is deadly earnest, struggling for painful authenticity. The ad hoc and probably one-shot group that calls itself the Royal Macadamians is not what I would call a major breakthrough in blending rock and world pop, but there's no question that their album Experiments in Terror is a lot of fun, not to say sometimes ridiculous.
Hahaha. houseboy once in Ocherias.
Everything about the Royal Macadamians has the air of a put-on. First, there's the name, which suggests that they're from, you know, Macadamia, which is a tree, not a place. Who they are really is producer and former rock critic David Sigerson, engineer John Beverly Jones, and multi-instrumental musicians Phil Schonale and Bob Teeley Jr. After making up tunes and goofing around with them in the studio for a month, the Macadamians mailed out Experiments in Terror as a kind of Christmas present to friends in 1988. Well, one thing led to another, and now their prank has become an official consumer product. A couple of the seven tracks are simply mutant rock numbers, but the feel of Experiments in Terror is inseparable from Lebanese and Moroccan and Egyptian and Brazilian pop music. Several passages on Experiments in Terror are in rather poor taste, such as the gunfire and weeping included in the song Relax in Lebanon, and the truly gross Noel Coward imitation in the song Houseboy. But that's part of what makes it funky rock and roll. Also, the Macadamians cleverly plug into our discontinuous age, in which the soundtrack of your life changes beats every few seconds. One minute you're stepping to Quincy Jones on stage in Vegas, the next you're shuffling along through the bazaar in Cairo, Egypt. This kind of reckless eclecticism was once a defining characteristic of sharp rock and roll. Because it began as an outsider sound, it could pillage and satirize the mainstream music. Now that rock's become dominant, too often all it wants to do is satirize, or really invoke, itself and its past glories. International pop musicians are the ones picking up on rock sounds and making good-humored use of them. Quite correctly, I think, the Royal Macadamians see authenticity as the enemy in the pop assimilation process. They don't want to tell you how thoroughly grounded and well-studied they are in some form of foreign music. They want to tell you what they love listening to at home. And just playing what you want without caring if it sells or if anybody else even likes it is always a bit risky. No wonder they call the album Experiments in Terror.
Milo Miles contributes articles on pop music to The Village Voice and The New York Times. The Royal Macadamians album Experiments in Terror is on the Island record label.
Travailler la nuit.
This is Fresh Air.
Robert Cray has been hailed for reviving the blues, but he's also reviving the soul sound of the 60s. In fact, the Memphis horns, which used to back Otis Redding, are now in Cray's band. Unlike many of his predecessors, Cray's music isn't rooted in one region. He moved around a lot as a child, living on military bases in the Southeast and Northwest, as well as in Germany. Cray has been leading a band since 1974 and recording since 1978. A couple of singles from his 1986 album, Strong Persuader, were international hits. Cray has a new album called Midnight Stroll. From that album, this is My Problem.
Midnight Stroll. It's my own fault, yes it is. I'm so ashamed. Can't blame it on no one else. She was once my everything. I sit here alone.
The kind of soul and rhythm and blues that you sing are really dependent on the singer communicating feeling. That feeling is often pain.
Mm-hmm.
When you were younger, were you ever frustrated having a younger voice, a voice that hadn't really experienced all of the stuff it was singing about, and a voice that maybe, you know, sounded younger and sounded less
worn? I know what you're
saying. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. You know, to tell the truth, you know, when I started listening to a lot of blues and the rhythm and blues things, I was really interested in the guitar work.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I can listen to those records that I listened to back then now and understand them in a whole different way. I think that the fact that you get a little bit older and you've gone through a certain amount of relationships, that you understand what these guys were singing about a long time ago.
What came first for you, singing or playing guitar?
Playing guitar. And I didn't get into singing until one day one of the, a singer quit on right before an audition.
An audition for what?
An audition for a high school dance.
And so you figured you'd try it? Or were you assigned to do it?
I always sang background, you know, for some of the songs we did, but I never took the lead chores until that time.
And you liked it?
Yeah, I enjoy it now.
And then?
Well, you know... You know, as you go along, I mean, you know, you start off and you're really nervous. And in the early days of the Cray Band, I mean, I couldn't even say anything to people, you know, between songs. Richard Cousins, our bass player, he always had to announce the songs, and I'd just stand back there almost with my back turned to the audience and just walk up to sing. So, you know, it was difficult.
When did you start singing blues?
Started singing blues, when we started this band, actually. Well, in 74. But I'd been in a couple of bands that did a lot of rehearsing and no playing for about a year or so before that.
Were there parts of the blues you didn't relate to?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of the blues that I didn't relate to. Basically, being that I'm from a military background and being on the West Coast, I mean, you find it hard to try to picture some of the elder bluesmen being down in the South and living the lives that they had to live back in those days, coming from plantations and playing for the little dances and fish fries and things like that. All these things were very interesting, but it was a whole different kind of thing that I couldn't relate to. But the main thing about it was what I liked about the music was the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the fact that there was a guy named Howling Wolf. with a name like Howling Wolf, and then when you put on his record, he would howl. and he would always make his midnight creep and come out, and his voice was such that it would scare you into believing what he was talking about.
A lot of the songs that you sing are really about things you probably could relate to. Do you
mm-hmm.
know what I mean? They're not standard blues lyrics, as if there's a standard, but there is a kind of variation on the theme.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of a song like Right Next Door,
mm-hmm.
which was on your Strong Persuader album. This is the story of a musician who's on the road. He's in a hotel room. He's had an affair with the woman in the next room. And he's listening through the walls, and he can hear that her boyfriend's breaking up with her. Did you write that song?
No, I had a lot to do with the music of it. But Dennis Walker, our producer and good friend I've known since 77, wrote that song. There's some funny things about Dennis Walker I always have to mention. He comes up with some great ideas. You see, Dennis is a happily married man, but he's been married 3 times. So I wonder sometimes.
I heard him shout, "Who is he?" She mumbled low. He said, "Baby, don't you lie to me no more." And I'm listening through these thin walls, silent shame, as he called out my name. I was right next door.
because of me. Because of me. It's because of me. Oh, she was right next door, and I'm such a strong persuader. But she was just another notch on my guitar. She's gonna lose the man that really loves her. In the silence, I can hear their breaking heart.
Well, I have to tell you, you know, everybody who works on Fresh Air has been stopping into my office and saying, listen, you really ought to ask him if he lives those lyrics, you know, if he's really been around as much as those lyrics would imply. You know, if he's been the backdoor man a lot, is what a lot of people have suggested I ask you.
Well, you know, you can believe some of the stories, but then you can't believe everything now. That's all I'll say.
Fine. It's kind of paradoxical, you know, the music that you sing comes out of black culture, but I think nowadays there's largely a white audience for blues and soul and some kinds of rhythm and blues. Mm-hmm. Does that jive with what you've perceived? I mean, with the
That's
reality?
Exactly what's going on. There's a thing where a lot of blues and rhythm and blues isn't getting played on radio, except for if you listen to public broadcasting and a few college radio stations. That's about it. And also for the fact that a lot of blacks have shunned the blues, so to speak. They don't listen to it anymore. So when you do hear it, it's usually around a college or it's on public broadcasting. And so therefore, it's just that's basically it.
Why do you think that is? And why do you think it is that a lot of black listeners have given up on blues?
Well, I think for a lot of people, it's the fact that it reminds us of the old times, something everybody wants to get away from, to better themselves in white American society. You have to get rid of the past, and I think blues music has to go along with it.
When you were getting started, you toured with bluesman Albert Collins.
Right.
What did that open your eyes up about? Anything? You know, you were still young and probably very impressionable.
Exactly. The first time I saw him was in '69, and I saw him outdoors playing guitar behind his back. He was really loud because he's from Texas. Most Texas musicians are loud. And he really impressed me like that, you know. And we got a chance to work with Albert, and it really showed me how to play a supportive role behind a musician such as him. Also, we traveled with him quite a bit, and he taught us how to pack, you know, for going out on the road, things like that, how to collect our money from corrupt club owners, and just what kind of attitude to take out with you when you went out on the road. Simple things like that.
I'd be interested in some of the things he shared with you about how to collect money from corrupt club owners.
I'd rather not talk about those things now.
Why not?
Oh, I don't know. There's some weird ways of collecting your money, I tell you.
Did you ever have to use any of those when you were on your own?
Oh, yeah. See, Richard and I would have this trick. See, Richard did most of the talking, and sometimes, you know...
This is Richard Cousins, your bassist?
Richard Cousins, a bass player, you know. Since I was really quiet, and Richard did all the talking, he would go and collect the money for us when we were traveling by ourselves without a tour manager, you know. And if he had a problem and the club owner was trying to take the money from the door, he'd say, "Now you don't want me to go back and get Robert, do you?" And sometimes I would have to walk in. And I had I can put on this scowling face. See, and everybody knew me as one that wouldn't say anything. But, you know, not knowing what my reaction might be physically, I mean, they were scared even, you know, to take that challenge, you know. And a couple times I did have to walk in, and I'd walk into the office, and I'd just sit there with this look on my face, and we'd get our money.
Robert Cray, from his new album, Midnight Stroll, this is The Things You Do to Me.
It's been so long, I really need to see you, baby. So long, when I called you up and talked to you yesterday, baby, you really rocked me. Oh, you rock me. I made
the things you do to me. Yeah.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we'll have the second of our reports from Linda Wertheimer on the Florida governor's race, paying attention to negative advertising. The newspapers there are actually reporting on and analyzing the television commercials of the candidates, and we'll hear about, among other things, the Florida gubernatorial mud meter. Also on today's program, a showdown over the budget deficit plan on Capitol Hill, and a talk with an East German pastor in Leipzig about what it's like for him going from a church that has been underground and a center of protest to being a church that's, in his words, established.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Poet Mark Halliday joins us with a literary, environmental, romantic fantasy.
The Ivory Novel. It occurs to me now that I could write a novel about the fate of the elephant, the illegal hunting of elephants in Africa. I feel now how I could do this, a thick, strong, solid novel of bitter realism. There would be the young, naive journalist who slowly catches on to the obscenity of the hunting, and there would be the cynical older man, an embassy official, maybe, or a wildlife photographer, who somehow finds himself beginning to care, until by page 200 he cares desperately. Maybe because of a certain woman who loves animals. Through her eyes, he can see the great sweet nobility of the lumbering elephants, and when he comes upon the hacked gray corpses in their lakes of dried mammal blood, he feels the quickening of rage that makes him younger, but also, of course, more vulnerable. Thus, it will be the young journalist who ends up stronger, though at the same time hardened, divested of the charming illusions that made him so funny in the first 100 pages. And he's the one who finally gets the girl, or woman, whatever. Unless there'd be two women, yes, a sultry brunette and this younger, very slim one. Lots of possibilities. So, three or four characters on the good side versus the foul poachers, swarthy types soaked with sweat, and the greedy ivory dealer who owns 5 airplanes and bribes the police of Kenya, Uganda, Zaire, and ultimately arranges the murder of one protagonist in the teeming marketplace of Bujumbura because he or she knows too much. But meanwhile, the dealer is actually subtly unhappy, and one long night he reveals this to the woman from the park service in a dialogue that deepens my novel considerably. Also, huge heaps of local color, the wind on the veldt, the herds wandering on immemorial paths, the humorless lions watching from the tall grass, and red dust billowing from the wheels of bouncing jeeps. All this, 320 pages. I could do this. Presumably, I would need, in addition to research, a trip to Kenya for 3 weeks to pick up details for that texture of authenticity. This investment would pay off, because I can see how my book would be a hit. I can see an ad that says shattering and incredibly moving, and a review that mentions not only Peter Matheson, but also Conrad as my sort of equals. I can see the glossy jacket. It gives me a thrill of deathlessness. Fellow creatures. I see myself in years thereafter feeling at times that I have actually helped save the African elephant from extinction. Would that be true? I guess not. Possibly, but I think not. Undoubtedly, I could help the elephant in more direct ways if I wanted to. And my novel, though moving, would have a tragic darkness that tends to discourage activism. For instance, in chapter 12, we find that one of the foul poachers is not really foul at all, but a man with 5 children, a father who believes that without the work of his heavy rifle, his sickly daughters would die. Mubendi carries photos of them in the leather case that holds his long gray bullets. Ah, literary art. Art eternal over here, and over there, real elephants with shattered brains. I guess I'm not going to write the elephant novel, but I guess I'll write poems in some ways not different.
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Richard Parker, and Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If you want to hear Carly Simon's You're So Vain, performed by the metal band Faster Pussycat, tune into the next Fresh Air. We'll talk with Lenny Kaye about producing an unusual anthology commemorating Elektra Records' 40th anniversary. And we'll talk about his years as Patti Smith's lead guitarist. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.